Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight's topic is Part 3 of the JonBenet Ramsey case. I'm Kim Colton, Director of Research for CrimeWire. I'll be manning the switchboard and monitoring the chat room. And now let me introduce the host of tonight's show, statement analyst and CrimeWire consultant, Peter Hyatt. Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you, Kim?
I'm wonderful. Great day here.
Beautiful very cold nice. Day here in Maine.
Yeah, well, cold here too, but, you know, it's February, so you know there's light at the end of the tunnel. It's not a train.
Oh, yeah. We have strep throat and all sorts of illnesses going around on Sunday. We're at the doctor's office, and it was jam-crowded, and so something's going on here in Maine that's been pretty unpleasant, but we had just gotten past the flu and out of the flu epidemic that seemed to hit us, and now everyone is coming down with something else, so kind of crazy, but we're getting through it.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Well, what's on the agenda tonight? We have Part 3 of the JonBenet Ramsey case, and something very interesting has come out, but I'll let you take the reins on this, Peter, and start where you want to start. But we're going to get to the Boulder grand jury.
Sure, and this
very
is
very interesting.
Yeah, it's actually an amazing thing for us to learn all these years later, because what has happened is that I've covered the case, and other statement analysts have covered the case since it broke. In early 1997. And the analysis from the statements has been consistent throughout. There hasn't been any analyst that I know of that has said these statements show veracity, these statements show that John and Patsy are truthful. In fact, every analyst that I have either read or talked to or communicated with in any way has said the same things, that the statements of the parents indicate deception, cooperation one with another, and everyone has found that within the language of the parents is both sexual abuse and the knowledge of sexual abuse. So in a way, not only the lead detective Steve Thomas, was he justified in writing his book, but the analysis is in agreement with what we've just learned within the last several weeks, that the grand jury voted to indict John and Patsy Ramsey. What that means is that they found that the evidence in the case showed that they were likely to have caused the death of JonBenet in the house due to child abuse. That was what was leaked out. To this, the language agrees, the analysis agrees. Probably most people with common sense agree, in spite of the inflamed passions about and around the case. People had the Patsy did it camp, John did it camp, and the intruder camp did it. But what I'd like to focus tonight is kind of wrapping it up in the sense that we've given out little bits and pieces of analysis, and now it's time to look at a bigger picture of what happened.
Right. But, and I just gotta interject here, Peter, and just say that I was one of those that could not believe. I knew in my heart of hearts, and I knew, I mean, rationally, intelligently, she wrote that note. But for some reason, I just couldn't wrap my head around that happened. I even wanted to blame the Burke. I anything but that. But you have completely turned me around. I just want to say that because I know I was kind of giving you a little bit of a hard time. So.
No, it's good to question everything. In fact, that's part of the strength of analysis is that we ask people to stop and consider these things, and then we say, you know, for instance, when you talk about water in a statement, are there other cases where you can point to where water or opening doors or windows, that sort of thing, indicate sexual abuse? And, you know, the answer, of course, is yes. That type of iron sharpening iron, good questioning, I think is a big help. So, no, I don't consider it a hard time at all. One of the things
well,
we're going to look at tonight... Yeah, one of the things we'll look at tonight is Steve Thomas's resignation letter that when he quit being a cop, which is fairly unusual, he had submitted a letter in August of 1998, and there's a little-known fact in that letter that people may not realize. In just the normal course of an investigation, this is how it works. A child was found dead, an autopsy was done, the autopsy showed the cause of death was... both asphyxiation, and there was blunt force trauma to the head. And there was internal debate on whether or not the blunt force trauma to the head came first. Was she unconscious? They thought she was dead, and then they squeezed the rest of the life out of her, or how actually did that work?
Mm-hmm.
And that's open to doctors' debate and that sort of thing. When the case first broke, I had just... the same prejudice that many people, I think, had, thinking that no way that these parents did it. And, of course, that was against the rationale of the way they dressed her and the bizarre behavior. But it became evident very quickly that these parents were withholding information and that were not cooperating to find their daughter's killer. And the only parents that are not going to cooperate to find the daughter's killer are those that don't want their daughter's killer found. And that quickly became evident. But a little-known fact is that there was analysis, statement analysis, at the time of the Ramsey's interviews that you can hear in their statements they're well aware of the analysis and their lawyers prepared them to go before the cameras. And so John Ramsey went before a camera. He said, I just want everyone to know, I did not kill my daughter, JonBenet. Just like that. Now, we say that someone cannot issue a reliable denial, but we always qualify it in what we call the free editing process. In other words, if you have a statement prepared for you where it says, I did not kill my daughter, JonBenet, he knew to use the first person singular, the past tense, the event specific, he knew to use the possessive pronoun my, mm-hmm. and to use her name. So everything was just too perfect, and it was obviously a prepared statement. If I say to you, Kim, did you take that money out of that woman's purse? And you say, no, I didn't take that money out of that woman's purse. You're literally reflecting my language back to you. Back to me, I'm sorry. It's not considered a reliable denial. When you're speaking on your own, when you're speaking and choosing your own words, that's when we enter what's called the free editing process. So if I ask you what you did this morning, you're going to have to leave out information, otherwise the entire hour of the program will be gone before you get mm-hmm. 5 or 10 minutes into your morning. Mm-hmm. So you're going to skip certain details, and we all do it. That's called the editing process. It's when you are deliberate in withholding sensitive or uncomfortable information is where we pick up deception, where mm-hmm. you don't want us to find. So when John and Patsy Ramsey begin to answer questions for themselves, that's where we find their deception. So we look at the 911 call. The 911 call sounded staged. It did not, and when I mean sounded, I mean the words they used, not the voice inflection. The words sounded rehearsed. They did not sound like a mother who was missing her child at all. We mm-hmm. saw that she didn't take ownership with the first person singular, that she shared with the plural, which is very unusual for a missing child and a mother with instinct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We went through that, and we saw that this was a call that indicated deception, what we call guilty knowledge call of a domestic homicide. The caller had knowledge,
wow.
guilty knowledge of what happened. Yeah.
Wow.
But I want to touch on Steve Thomas.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely.
He wrote a letter to the chief of police, and he resigned. And let's mm-hmm. just get the beginning part of it. He said, on June 22nd, I submitted a letter to Chief Covey requesting a leave of absence from the Boulder Police Department. In response to persistent speculation as to why I chose to leave the Ramsey investigation, this letter explains more fully those reasons. Although my concerns were well known for some time, I tried to be gracious in my departure, addressing only health concerns. However, after a month of soul-searching and reflection, I feel I must now set the record straight. The primary reason I chose to leave is my belief that the district attorney's office continues to mishandle the Ramsey case. I had been troubled for many months with many aspects of the investigation, albeit an uphill battle of a case to begin with. It became nearly impossible investigation because of the political alliances, philosophical differences, and professional egos that blocked progress in more ways and on more occasions than I can detail in this memorandum. I and others voiced these concerns repeatedly. In the interest of hoping justice would be served, we tolerated it, except for those closed-door sessions when detectives protested in frustration, where fists hit the table, where detectives demanded that the right things be done. The wrong things were done, and it made a matter of simple principle that I could not continue to participate as it stood with the district attorney's office. As an organization, we remained silent when we should have shouted. So this was a major concern about the district attorney's office. Here's where we get some information that people are not perhaps familiar with. The Boulder Police Department took a handful of detectives after the murder and handed us this case. As one of those five primary detectives, we tackled it for a year and a half. We conducted an exhaustive investigation, followed the evidence where it led us, and were faithfully and professionally committed to this case. Although not perfect, cases rarely are. During 18 months on the Ramsey investigation, my colleagues and I worked the case day and night in spite of tied hands. On June 1 and 2, 1998, we crunched 30,000 pages of investigation to its essence and put our cards on the table, delivering the case in a formal presentation to the district attorney's office. We stood confidently in our work. Very shortly thereafter, though, the detectives, who knew the case better than anyone, were advised by the district attorney's office that we would not be participating as grand jury advisory witnesses. Mm. And that is shocking.
It is. It is. And that's that Hunter. OMG. Hey, Peter, I got to tell you, we've got one of our fabulous listeners on the line with us tonight, and it is Hobnob.
Hi, honeys. How are you doing?
How are you, Hobnob?
I'm doing good. I've got chicken wings in the oven, so if I disappear briefly, that's why. Maple syrup, barbecue, chicken wings. Ooh.
Ooh, sounds wonderful.
I know. Ooh. I know. It's a good excuse and the remedy to deal with the wind and the rain that we've got at the moment.
We've got a lot of snow and a lot of cold weather, don't we, Peter?
That we do.
You can keep that. We've had it. I don't want it anymore. We're supposed to get some more this week, but, you know, I'm hoping it will go your way rather than my way.
We'll get
deep snow and short legs are a really bad combination.
And Peter, one thing you wanted to ask of Hobbs is, what does she think happened in that house that night? And since we've got some great wings coming up, let's ask her that question. And what do you think, Peter?
Well, before you get there, how about this?
Yeah. Okay.
What do you think of the detectives not being invited into the grand jury? Mm. In our system, the American system here, it's probably the most common thing is that a grand jury gets a case presented to them by the district attorney, where they're allowed to ask questions of the witnesses, especially of the detectives that investigated the case. I don't know of a murder case where detectives were not allowed to come into the grand jury to answer questions. So before you get to the big question, how about that one? You want to tackle that?
It's weird, really, because it almost sounds like someone's pulling a few strings to make sure that the Ramseys don't get indicted. It's telling that the DA, the prosecuting DA, decided to find them not guilty rather than sort of follow the rule of law, take them to court, and let both sides get their story across. So it makes me wonder then, is money involved? Because we know that John Ramsey had aspirations for political office, and we know that the DA also has to be voted in and out. And it makes me wonder, was money passed over so that if you don't go against it. If you support me, then I'll see you good once I've been voted in.
That is great analysis there, because Peter, I didn't think of that.
Yeah, he actually had attempted to run for office later on, and
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was one of the things. Well, he's quite a character.
You've learned something new. Yay!
I have. Yay!
But you know, it's just why, you know, it's like they've completely gone against like the normal standard rule of law. It's like grand jury indicts, whether you agree with their verdict or not, you still have a duty to sign it off and take it to court. And then it's like he said, she said. So, I mean, it makes me wonder why it wasn't followed through. And I also wonder, because the grand jury indicted them and they weren't signed off and it wasn't taken to court, whether that is still valid and whether he can still be taken to court now.
Interesting. I think without the that signature, and then we know Alex Hunter was replaced by Mary Lacy. Without that signature, it didn't go forward. What I think is just a startling thing is that the purpose of a convenient grand jury is to get to the truth. And this is why grand juries have a lot of latitude to ask questions.
And oh, yeah. I mean, they'll ask all the hard questions that you don't really want people to answer.
Yeah.
And it's all stays in camera as well, so only the grand jury know what was actually asked and know what the answers were.
Yes, it's going to be something where they're going to get to the truth of what happened, and then the lawyers can begin to fight over it. But when the grand jury asks questions, they're generally very common sense questions. They're direct questions. They don't worry about how it's worded. They don't have to worry about objections. They're just there to get to the truth. It's just a very clean way of getting to the truth of what happened, fair for everyone, because we want to get to the truth. Defense attorney's job is not to win. It is to protect against malicious prosecution, but still to get to the truth, you know, technically.
Yeah.
In this case, not having the detectives there itself, I don't understand why there was not intervention on the part of the governor or others within the legal system. How could this possibly be that they were going to be shut outside the grand jury?
Exactly. The only way that makes any sense is if there's something nefarious going on. If somebody's pulling a few strings or has got something to hide, you know, it's like, who are they trying to protect themselves? Were they trying to protect Ramsey? Or you know, there's too many unanswered questions as to why it wasn't done. And I know that I would be demanding, because there's no statute of limitations on murder, I would be kicking up merry hell to get him charged.
But who kicks now for JonBenet all these years later? Who the only person that we could think about would be John Ramsey himself. But here, having the detectives block out of it is a major blow to justice and to the case.
Exactly.
Then, now take the factor is that they still indicted John and Patsy Ramsey in the death of their daughter. They still indicted in spite of not being able to hear from the detectives, the ground-level detectives themselves.
Oh, that's
so
amazing.
There must have been something. There must have been evidence that we don't know about.
Oh, of course,
that's what I'm thinking.
That's
what I'm thinking
too.
To
it.
Yeah,
with what we have even now is an incredible amount just to see the guilt of the Ramseys. But to imagine these people indicted, they fought for justice. The detectives fought with one arm tied behind their back, and they still won.
Yeah, because I noticed that I said when I pointed out that when you mentioned that the grand jury had indicted him, and I pointed out that now would be the time that he'll either start talking to his lawyers again, finding out how he stands with regard to that, whether if the indictment is signed off now, he can still be charged, and if so, whether he will blame Patsy, because we know Patsy wrote the notes. And now that she's dead, she can't defend herself. So he can say, she did this, she did that, blah, blah, blah. I protected her to save the family name, and that's it. And he walks away free, and everybody else sort of blames it all on Patsy.
Mm-hmm. I think the only way that happens is that if he gets an Oprah interview and a big boatload of money, and somehow he's able to protect Burke.
Oh,
I can see it.
I mean, it's a huge case. I mean, there's obviously interest in the story still.
Sure.
And
I
think
interest is incredible around the world.
There'll be somebody out there somewhere willing to pay money to interview him. I mean, we see it with Casey Anthony, we see it with the McCanns, that's going through court again at the moment. And it's like people with money who are pulling the strings. And if all else fails, they'll just claim some sort of addiction, they were abused, blah, blah, blah.
Oh,
pay me lots
yeah.
of money and I'll confess. And it'll be selective confessions.
Yeah, you have to arrange some kind of immunity deal for himself. He'd have to be advised very carefully on what not to say so he doesn't implicate himself. But I think that he could pull it off, a major pay-per-view type of money where he is able to go and throw Patsy under the bus. The only thing that may hinder that is his son, Burke.
Yeah, is Burke.
But having said that...
We don't know what the relation like is between him and his father. I mean, it could be a positive. It could be one of, like, you say something and the same thing is going to happen to you.
Yep. It also reflects the fact that I believe that he molested his daughter would mean he's not father of the year. So Burke probably has some indication that something was very wrong in his childhood anyway.
Yeah.
It's
I mean, what gets me, with all the advances in DNA these days, you know, and they still have all the samples, they could probably identify any unexplained DNA that was on the body. But it's just convenient that he found her, he runs over, he unties her, concealing any evidence such as, like, the way he tied the knots and stuff. Any fibers found on him can say, well, I picked her up, I did this, I did that. It's all come from her, any blood, any saliva, anything like that. It's all come because I picked her up.
Well, the two things that he talks about when he describes finding the body, two things that you're very well aware of.
Excuse me, I have to go along rescue the wings.
Yeah, he talks about the lights and the doors. And these are unnecessary references that we find are very strongly linked with sexual abuse and sexual activity. He did not need to tell us that, for instance, that he opened the door to find her. He just said that he could have said he went to the basement and found her. But in fact, he doesn't say that he found her. She wasn't lost in that sense. She wasn't missing. He said, I opened the door, and there she was. So he's the one that brought in that reference. And when he was asked about the allegation of sexual abuse, he didn't deny it. And we have a rule that we follow, that if someone doesn't deny something, we won't deny it for them. What he said was, those other allegations were the most hurtful to me. And I think that's probably true. But saying that they're hurtful and saying I didn't do it are two different things.
Exactly.
And he was not able to bring himself to say, I didn't molest JonBenet.
He tried to blame Burke and said it was Burke that did it. Burke was only, 9 years old, so it's unlikely he would have been prosecuted because they'd have said, oh, he's got some sort of mental problems because it's not normal that you do this kind of thing. Or he'd be prosecuted as a juvenile, wouldn't get much time at all.
The language from Patsy and John in their interviews shows that there is an awareness of the sexual abuse. And so if John was molesting JonBenet, as I believe he was, and there was the vaginal trauma, the bedwetting, the urinary tract infections, the language, all those things coming together. Patsy, in her language, especially in the reference to child, which talks about someone at risk, is acknowledging that she knows about it. She's linguistically revealing or indicating to us that she was aware of the sexual abuse. These two people had reason to be bound together, whether it was to protect their image, whether it was because either one could have nailed the other. They knew that they had to protect each other. They came up with a fake ransom note, which obviously Patsy is the author of the note, and she was not in a panic or a rush writing that note with the all the.
You wouldn't have been if you'd written a 3-page note plus a practice note as well. I mean, you're just sitting there, you're drinking coffee, you've got no rush.
That is just such an awful.
She was up all night. In the same clothes, the beauty queen was wearing the same clothes the next morning because she never went to bed. In fact, in her own book, and I read the Ramsey's book, she never said that she went to sleep.
They went to sleep. We can't do it for them. They can say, we went to bed, but we don't know what they did in bed.
Right, and the point is that some of these things are left out deliberately. But when he said, I opened the door, and there she was, we have both the door reference and we have the ability to avoid a direct lie where he doesn't want to say that he found her.
Put the light on as well, didn't he?
Yeah. And so what we do, this is a really interesting thing. I think that those who went to the LSI website may need a little bit of explanation with this. When Avinoam Sapir has a scan report. That's for his students. It's not for the public. It's so the public can look at that and say, well, what does that mean? That's for the students that have studied under him so they know. And what he did was he took the different references that John made, and he asked simply, when does he call her JonBenet? When does he call her daughter? Under what context?
Mm.
And, well, yes, it's really quite fascinating.
A change in language is a change in reality.
Exactly right. And we had...
Yay, I'm paying attention.
Somebody who was just taking, an investigator who just took our training a month or two ago, had said, oh, you know, I was listening to myself the other day, and I had written some things down that I had said, and I talked about my two sons, and I called them my boys, and then later on, I called them the guys. And I realized, because they're young, why did I call them the guys and not the two boys? What caused me to change my language? And she said they were out stacking firewood, the little guys, and she used the term guys because she was proud of them. And
exactly.
people don't realize how quickly they'll change the terms of what they call their children.
It depends on the situation and what they're doing. If they're sort of having temper tantrums, then they're like children. If they're doing something mature, like washing up, then you tend to upgrade them. So,
yeah,
you know, like with any case, you look at how they refer to the subject, you know, the child, when it changes, what it changes to, and when it changes back. And you'll find that there's a pattern every time.
Yep, we saw this in the case of Haley Cummings, where Ronald Cummings had the father. Haley Cummings was a five-year-old that was killed down in Florida a couple of years back. He was the father who was on Nancy Grace, and he was calling her Miss Nancy, and she was saying, Ronald, I can look in your eyes and know that you're a good dad, and just all that kind of silly stuff. And then later on, he's got 25 years or something, or 15, 25 years for drugs, but he was abusing his own daughter. He had admitted physically abusing her, but it was really interesting to listen to when he used the term my daughter and when he didn't. And recently I was teaching that, and this is the verbalized reality, no man can molest his own daughter. And people say, well, how can that possibly be? Men do molest their own daughters. No. What happens is they go through a process in their mind where the language changes because the heart changes. The daughter becomes, for instance, in a case we had recently, the girl, when he molested her. And then when his wife got home and the girl was safe again, the girl became my daughter. But he couldn't reference her as my daughter while molesting her because he had to turn her into the girl or the kid or something else in order to go ahead with his molestation.
Yeah. Also, it's like when children go missing, you'll find that perhaps they're referred to as my child, my daughter, the girl, or it or whatever, whilst they're in the home and alive. But as soon as the child has gone missing or is dead, it's like Madeline or Haley or whatever it is. They give them the name and they sort of personalize it. But they don't personalize the child whilst they're still alive and in the home and being abused.
With child molesters, there's a very specific thing we look for. Listen to this now. This is the interview that they gave on television, news conference, May 1st, 1997. So what we're listening for is the terms that John Ramsey used when he was describing JonBenet. He said, but because we were the parents of JonBenet, I did not kill my daughter, JonBenet. About the allegations that he molested her, they are totally false. JonBenet, and he stumbled on her name, and I had a very close relationship.
Well, now he's over-egging the pudding, isn't he? He's gone the exact opposite. Instead of, like, barely mentioning the name, it's like every other word is like JonBenet, 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 and that just draws attention to when he doesn't use it.
Sure. Now, here we go to some places where it changes now. He said, we were, as you could imagine, insulted that we even were considered suspects in the death of our daughter. So now she's our daughter, and we're talking about death. Then he said, our lives cannot go on the same as they might have been had JonBenet still been here. But there was an article in the Atlanta Constitution, Georgia says goodbye to JonBenet. We were terribly touched by that. that was just a very small part of Jean Benet's life, the beauty pageants. Then he said, and if that effect happened to more than one person, then Jean Benet's life had some meaning. So what was pointed out was when John Ramsay used the proper title, my daughter, it was only when denying the accusation of killing her and when talking about being suspects in her death. So my daughter is associated with the murder or being a suspect in the murder.
Mm-hmm.
Also notice that John Ramsay used the proper title daughter in proximity or closeness to the word kill and closeness to the word death. This connection between the proper title and JonBenet's death was also the same in the CNN interview. So in other words, John Ramsay maintains consistency in his language over the two interviews when he's using JonBenet, talking about her as alive, and daughter when talking about her as dead. While talking about her while she's alive, JonBenet, while talking about her when she's dead, daughter. Now you think about your child comes home with a bad report card and suddenly you're using the proper full name.
Right.
Peter Francis Hyatt, what did you do?
Always a bad sign when they use a proper name.
and then something good happens and the nickname is used. So in context, we look for the change, what that is. And here we're looking at obviously a very serious case and not a bad report card. Patsy Ramsay, she said, I'm Patsy Ramsay, JonBenet's mother. So unlike Patsy, John didn't use the title father. He only used the plural parents. And even though the proper title father is missing from his language, not only in regard to JonBenet, how he relates to him, but also to himself, how he relates to her.
It's also missing from Patsy's language as well. It's like she's the mother, but there's no sort of like official recognition of a father being there. And you think, well, why is there a need to distance the father from the dead daughter? And you only distance yourself from something when it's sensitive.
She read the denial. Now listen to this. After the denial, she said, I loved that child with all my heart and soul.
Oh, telling.
Yep, that child, distance.
Exactly.
And the word child, which is often used with sexual abuse. The word child in conjunction with the word love should raise a suspicion that Patsy Ramsay knows that JonBenet was sexually abused. It might also indicate that Patsy Ramsay herself might have been abused earlier in childhood. Very likely
sexual abuse.
It makes me wonder as well, because
John Ramsay married some Las Vegas showgirl costume designer, and my first thought was like, oh, that's what his fetish is. He likes sequins and stuff. And yeah, it wouldn't be at all surprised if he was the one who was pushing JonBenet into the pageants. And, you know, he's abusing his daughter. He's getting turned on by all the sequins and sparkles and showgirl look. And then he goes and marries a grown-up version of his dead daughter.
We also look at what the parents said about the investigation itself. Now, we know, for instance, that they refused to take a polygraph. We know that they refused to be interviewed early on, alone, separate, that they made all the rules and they blamed the police. I don't want to gloss over the fact that Alex Hunter was accused by Steve Thomas of sabotaging, not just impeding, but actually sabotaging. And this is true, that the grand jury brought back an indictment in spite of not being able to ask the police questions. So with one hand tied behind their back, they still won the brawl against Alex Hunter. His only way of avoiding going up against those high-priced attorneys and being humiliated in court was to refuse to sign the indictment.
He didn't want that. It's like if the parents are lying, they've got a reason to lie, we then have to find out why they're lying. Is it poor relationship or is it guilty knowledge? And it's the same pattern. You look at every single case, like the McCanns, JonBenet Ramsay, Ayla Reynolds, Lisa Irwin, and all that lot, and they all follow the exact same pattern. It's just so predictable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at some of the other things that they said that went on. When he said about the sexual abuse, he said, I can tell you those were the most hurtful innuendos to us as a family. They are totally false. Well,
that's some singular denial.
First of all, he does not deny, he doesn't say I didn't do it in regard to sexual abuse, but the allegation of sexual abuse was not against them as a family, it was against John personally. I can tell you those were the most hurtful innuendos to us as a family. They are totally false.
Sharing the guilt.
Yes. He's sharing the guilt and he's avoiding saying, I didn't do it. Even when Patsy Ramsey, in her denial, had to add on the extra words, I did not have anything to do with it. An emphasis
what is it that she's referring to? You know, it's like you've got to pin them down. They can't say, oh, I didn't do that, or I didn't do it, or whatever. You have to say, well, what is that? What is it? If you didn't do that, then there has to be a this that you did do.
Some of the interesting quotes from him, though, he said, I think one of the issues that was distressing to us and perhaps caused some bias of opinion is, why did we bring lawyers into this process so early on? So it, for him, it wasn't his daughter's murder. It was a process. And he said, as a person, I think it makes you much more guarded. He wasn't concerned about anyone being, killer being out there, that sort of thing. He was very, very close to the vest and was more concerned with the investigation than he was about his own daughter's murder, which was really
if it was a break-in and intruder actually killed her, how come there was deafening silence, no sort of demands to say, like, protect your children, lock up your house, blah, blah, this, he'll do it again. Because if you've killed a child once and you're a paedophile, you're going to do it again. It's a given. It's just a case of how many you kill before you get caught. And it's like with the McCann's case. They said, oh, there's an abductor out there, blah, blah, blah. And in 6 years, there's never been another case like Madeline's. And it's like, well, that's rather telling then, isn't it? Because if they've done it once, they're going to do it again. Why is it taking so long for them to actually do anything? So all the sort of signs point to the parents, and they're currently going through court at the moment again. So it makes you wonder. It's like not what they're saying, but also what they're not saying and what they're not doing.
One of the things we ask people to look at is the word normal when it comes to someone describing themselves as being normal. And we saw this in the case of Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, where people were lining up on either sides of the case, and was it sexual harassment, was it not, who's telling the truth, who is lying. What Anita Hill indicated was that it wasn't sexual harassment, but actually it was a discussion about heterosexuality versus homosexuality. And Anita Hill said that she now had a good relationship with her church, indicating that by using the word now, that perhaps there was a time when she wasn't. And then she went on to call herself a normal person. And so we asked, who is someone that uses the word normal?
And somebody who's been called not normal.
Yeah, someone that who has been in the past has either thought of themselves or others have thought of them as not normal. So when someone says, I'm a normal person, it's an indication that either they or someone else has considered them not normal.
Not normal. Yeah.
Sure.
I'm not normal, but I'm just creative in my own universe.
It's the same as storytelling where someone says, yeah, where someone says, it was a normal night like any other. What they're telling you is about to be, even a first grader reader knows when someone says it was a normal night like any other, they know something out of the normal is about to take place.
Ordinary is going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
Well, listen to the statement that John made. We think we are a normal American family that loves and values their children.
Mm.
What he's saying is, first of all, we, not I, but we, so he's sharing that, gets weaker. Then he says, we think. That's weaker. Instead of saying, I am a normal man or we are a normal family, he's saying he only thinks it. He allows for others to think otherwise.
Exactly.
And the fact that he has to say that he's normal or that we're normal tells us this family is anything but normal.
Yeah,
so when people first saw them and saw the inappropriate sexualization of this child and the bleached hair and the false teeth and the shaking of her behind to the music, the America knew this was not a normal family in any shake of a stick. But their declaration of it, his declaration of it, tells us that there's something very, very wrong in that family.
Also, if it's introduced in free editing, instead of saying, being asked, how do you think of yourself, blah, 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 if he actually introduces the new language in, like, I'm normal, my family's normal, then it's sensitive, and you think, well, what's brought that on? What has made him come out and say that he's normal? Because he's comparing it to another thought.
Right. And that thought is something that is not normal, and that's where it's coming from. And that's why when someone says, okay, she was dressed inappropriately. She had a history of bedwetting, and she had urinary tract infections. There's no surprise that the autopsy would show vaginal trauma, because all the pieces of the puzzle came together. The pattern of bedwetting and the urinary tract infections, the constant going back to the doctors, didn't happen by an intruder. This was all pre-intruder. We look at that, and then we look at the language later on, and it matches. And this is what we're getting, is we're getting match after match after match. This little girl died in that house under the hands of her parents. I don't see anything linguistically that puts the other child, Burke, into the equation.
Exactly.
The only thing we know about
if
him
it's old, if it's
that
old,
he was getting up in the middle
trauma.
Of the night or something.
Yeah, if it's all vaginal trauma, I mean, if it was a one-off, they could say, oh, the intruder did it and she died accidentally. But if there's evidence of old assault, that can't be passed off as an intruder. They'd have to then say, well, either it's somebody known to the family, which then sort of opens the floodgates, or it points straight at them.
One of the things that John said early on television, because here he was going on television and speaking, where they were refusing to speak to the police, he said, we have to find out why this happened. The only way that my family can move on now is to resolve why, who this happened. These are direct quotes. Who would ask why like this happened? If you thought an intruder did it, you wouldn't be asking why, but asking who.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really,
and
really strange.
Order is important as well. Instead of saying who did it and then why, he's asking why was it, and then, oh, who did it?
The strange distancing language that we heard of him, here's the exact quote from before. When I opened the door, there were no windows in that room, and I turned on the light, and that was her. Here's a quote again. When I opened the door, there were no windows in that room, mm-hmm. and I turned the light on, and that was her.
Weren't there photographs of windows in the basement where she was found? So the way he says it, it's like you turn the light on and bingo, instant window.
We find that in an open statement, when someone has a need to turn on the lights, to say that they turn on the lights, it usually has to do with a sexual motive for the crime. Here we have both the door opening and we have the light turning on. There's no reason for him to tell us either of those things. There's no reason for him to tell us there's no windows in that room. And he doesn't say,
except
I found
for detail,
her.
Isn't it?
He says, that was her. That was her. So when we think about the grand jury...
It's a strange thing to say, though, isn't it? Yeah,
that
was her. Why not say, and there she was, or my daughter lay there. Why, that was her. I mean, that is distancing, and her is just, like, really distancing.
I can't imagine what those detectives felt like, having worked for a year and a half, day and night, and I'm willing to bet they did a lot of hours without being paid overtime just because budgets don't allow for that sort of thing in general. To have worked and then taken 30,000 pages of document, had to bring it down to something that was really presentable, having made the presentation, having known that they got the killers caught, having followed the evidence to where it led them, and then to have this arrogant saboteur say to them, you're not coming in to the grand jury. There should have been something should have been done at that point legally to stop that.
Exactly.
That was sabotage.
I certainly will
consider the idea that this went on with political ramifications, but one thing that I saw myself in listening to Alex Hunter was he trembled. He trembled before those other attorneys. There was no possibility that this guy would ever allow himself to be humiliated. What mattered to him was protecting his own reputation. And those Atlanta lawyers that he would have been up against probably would have shredded him, probably would have embarrassed and humiliated him. But it was his obligation to try. Then the behavior of Mary Lacey was, I guess it wasn't worse, but it was pretty bad itself. What she did was she looked for any opportunity to clear the Ramseys, to save the embarrassment from the office and perhaps a deal with Alex Hunter. So there's a kook, John Mark Carr, is a kook out there who's been writing letters for a long time about being in love with JonBenet. He's obviously a pedophile. He has the nickname Captain High Pants because when he was arrested in Thailand, they took his belt away from him. And so he was hoisting his pants up really high, and it was Glenn Beck, I believe, on television who called him Captain High Pants, and the name kind of stuck. It was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what Mary Lacy did was she issued an arrest warrant for him without checking any facts. All she knew is that this guy was a creepy guy writing letters about how in love he was with her to a professor. She had no evidence. She spent the money to have him extradited from Thailand, arrested, cameras called in Thailand and in the United States. He lands in the United States. They take him to Boulder, Colorado. Before checking anything, she sets up huge tables with all her staff around her, and they spend about 60 minutes congratulating one another on what an amazing work they did, justifying that the Ramses didn't do it.
What's the matter with interest?
John Mark Carr lands in the United States, and they say, was he in Boulder when JonBenet was killed? No, he wasn't there. Did anyone check this out? No.
No.
They were humiliated.
No.
It was one of the most narcissistic displays I'd ever seen. It was just incredible. I'm sorry, I think we're cross-talking. One of the most incredibly narcissistic, self-congratulatory press conferences I've ever seen. One by one by one, the Mutual Admiration Society, you're the best, no, you're the best, no, you're the best, back and forth, this love fest, heaping praise upon themselves, only to learn that Captain High Pants was never there and that a simple phone call, a two-minute phone call, would have verified that this nut job couldn't have done it because he wasn't there when she died. He didn't sit in the house for hours on end writing it. He didn't get up in the middle of the night and feed her pineapple. He didn't keep John and Patsy Ramsey up and have coffee with them while they remained in the same clothes they had the night before. None of those things. Mary Lacy now is humiliated, and it continues. So when a piece of DNA, which is not identified, was found, instead of saying there's a piece of DNA that's unidentified, well, to identify, no, she says, this proves the Ramses didn't do it. That proves nothing. That's as strong as evidence as Captain High Pants. It means nothing.
Exactly. Can she be prosecuted for obstruction of justice, I wonder? Same with the DA who didn't sign the indictment.
You know, I wondered about that then, and I wonder about that now. How does she even have a career to be able to do something, this much folly, this much incredible folly, to avoid having to face up to responsibilities? How hard did they work, Alex Hunter and Mary Lacy, how hard did they work at not working, at not doing their job? It was just a public embarrassment. Now, the Colorado Press did cover it, but I think some of the writers were a little bit concerned about the wrath of Mary Lacy and even Alex Hunter at the time, some of the backlash, because they wanted to keep their sources going. But this guy was giving tips to that pimply-faced National Enquirer. What's his name? Jeff Shapiro.
I know who you mean. Yes. Yes.
who still feigns to be a writer and still just as bad as he was when he was, you know, years ago. He wrote recently about it, and it was just as goofy as it was 15 years ago.
Yeah, but we have that here. We have a whole bunch of, with Madeleine McCann, because apparently the McCanns have suspended their libel case against Gonzalo Amaral, who was the chief detective, but they've currently got Tony Bennett going through court. And it was the first day today. They're trying to claim that he broke the rules regarding what he could say and what he couldn't say. So they're dragging him through court. But it looks like the judge is going to go for a full libel trial, in which case the McCanns will run. But, you know, it's like when something sensitive comes out, the trolls come out. And I always know when something sensitive has come out because they all come running in, sort of like shouting and pointing in various directions, like, looky over here, don't look over there. And it's quite amusing because I like to poke them with a very large pointy stick. And Peter's very good because he does sometimes let me play.
Let's get to a little bit of the Sabotage by Alex Hunter.
Oh, yes.
Steve Thomas wrote this.
Oh, yeah. A lot of that.
In a departure from protocol, police reports, physical evidence, and investigative information was shared with Ramsey defense attorneys. All of this in the district attorney's office, spirit of cooperation, quote unquote. I served a search warrant, only to find later defense attorneys were simply given copies of the evidence it yielded. An FBI agent, who I didn't even know, quietly tipped me off about what the DA's office was doing behind our backs, conducting an investigation the police department was wholly unaware of.
Of course, you've got to give the defense and the suspects an idea of what evidence is against them so they can come up with a reasonable explanation for it.
Alex Hunter deliberately sabotaged the investigation, deliberately gave evidence away, evidence that still the grand jury handed down an indictment against the Ramseys for. They could be prepared even for it. So the defense attorneys got the information from Alex Hunter before disclosure was mandated, and the detectives were not allowed to testify before the grand jury. I don't know what else he could have done to sabotage it. I don't know how much worse. So bad that an FBI agent probably risked his job to go and tell the lead detective, you're being screwed from behind the back here where you don't even know it, to the point where the district attorney's office is doing their own investigation and they're going to find someone who will claim the intruder theory is real.
You pay somebody enough money, they'll say anything.
Well, and then we learned about the polygraphs where one of the attorneys took John and Patsy from polygrapher to polygrapher, and everywhere they went, they failed. They finally found one guy who would pass them, made him sign a red dog contract that said he would not disclose the questions asked. It took a while, but they found someone that would pass them, someone that would take enough ambiguous questions and ambiguous responses and say, well, I can't say they failed. But even then, he had to sign that contract that would not allow him to speak and even let people know what questions he asked. Like, for instance, did you kill your daughter? Did you write the ransom note? Even these things were not allowed to be disclosed.
I wonder, is there anything to say that he can't call in anonymously and say, look, I've heard from blah, 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 that they failed the polygraph and these were the questions asked? And what penalties could he possibly face by revealing the truth?
Yeah, I wonder if this is going to come out or if it even has come out as part of that last thing about the grand jury, because the grand jury likely heard about the failed polygraphs and that sort of thing. They get to hear everything. And that's the way it should be.
As soon as it came out that he'd been indicted, that the grand jury had indicted him, I said then that he's going to be talking to his lawyers, and he's going to see what his options are as to whether he needs to sort of start hiring bigger attorneys to sit on it or to deny. And we saw what he did. He just denied and pretty much mocked it.
One of the most shameful episodes in American justice that rivals perhaps like the O.J. Simpson jury, the Michael Jackson paying off of child molestation victims. I've just never seen it from this type of angle, this severe, where one guy was so determined to pervert justice. You know, you can understand someone doing this because they don't want to go to prison. But for Alex Hunter, just out of fear, his own narcissism and fear of being looked as a fool, he could have passed this off to anybody. He could have passed this off to someone else, but he needs to protect his political office more than anything else. And it was a disgrace. It was a disgrace. We're getting close to the time when we're running out, so both of you want to give your opinion on what you think happened?
Go ahead.
You go ahead, kid.
Well, I like I said in the beginning of the program, I was just like, I cannot believe that they were involved. I could not believe that. And Peter has turned me around. I obviously see the light. My opinion
is... train's coming down the tunnel.
Yes, the train. Yeah, the train came down the tunnel and oh. But, it's if Burke grows up to be 50, 60 years old, he might divulge something. I don't see it happening in my lifetime, but
Well, it's a lot of guilt there, isn't it? If you know that a parent has killed a sibling, they're always going to have that fear that if you get married and have kids, that something might happen to your children.
Sure, right, exactly. I mean, Burke, I'm sure, is... And then, I'm sure she was number one in the household, don't you think?
Oh, yes. She forgave the money in big time.
Number one.
You know, she's the one that got all the money and the status and everything else.
Right.
Which is
and,
what they
and
wanted.
Made her
they
mother, wanted to... And made her mommy proud and made her daddy molester, whatever. I shouldn't say that, but, you know, I mean... It just, anyways, that's where I'm at. Hobbs, go ahead.
Well, I mean,
please.
When I first heard of it, my first thought was a dead child in the house is the family's involved. And then when I heard about the ransom note, I said, there's no way that any abductor would do that. They'd spend all the time writing out this note and then leave the child in the basement. The first thing any abductor would do is just get out the house as fast as possible. Look, a quick note saying, we've got your child, we want X amount of money, we'll contact you, whatever. That is what you do. You don't write essays saying how you feel and what your beliefs are and why you're doing this and blah, blah, blah. That's not relevant. All they want is the money.
Mm-hmm.
And anything apart from, you know, a few lines saying, we've got your kid, we want the money, is not believed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and then I thought, well, it's snow, so were there no footprints? Because if it's snow, you leave footprints. And if somebody got into the house and killed her, they'd have to leave as well. So you've got footprints going into the property and out the property.
Yeah, I know. That's one thing that swayed me was that when you look at the photos, in Colorado, I know Colorado, it the snow had melted. And you couldn't see it anymore. You don't know where the footprints were. It was just weird. But anyway.
It's like anything else. It's like if snow's melted, the ground is going to be wet. And wet ground, especially mud, will leave footprints. You leave a mark. Every time you go somewhere, you leave a part of yourself there and you take something from there out with you. So there would have been footprints of some kind. There'd have been marks on the window if they got in that way because they had to climb over stuff. There'll be mud. There'll be all sorts. And all that was missing. So, you straight away say, right, there's no external... abductor. So it's either it has to be somebody that got into the house. So they either came in the house with the family or it's a family member. And then you just look at the expected, and if it's not there, you look for the unexpected. If you see
right.
What I mean.
Yeah, I do. Oh, God, I just love you so much. Peter.
Oh, and it's not even Valentine's yet.
I know. I just love you
yourself.
So much.
I love me as well. That makes two of us.
Peter,
I've got two horse on the keyboard as well. That's really good tonight. Oh, thank you.
You're very good. Very good.
Barbecue and stuff. It was sticky and wonderful.
Peter,
and I've got a full tummy.
Let me wrap this up, okay? We've got a minute and four left. Is that okay with you, Peter?
Yeah, I think that JonBenet got up in the middle of the night. The mother gave her pineapple. She wouldn't go to bed, or she wet her bed again. The mother lost her temper and swatted at her. She fell, hit her head, went unconscious. They conspired together, thinking that she was already dead or about to die, that they didn't want to face the scrutiny of the media. Patsy said, you help me, or I'll tell them you were molesting her. And they had each other at the throat. She wrote a very lengthy ransom note with language that was taken from them personally, language that came from the books and the videos that were in the house, and that it was an unintended death that came from a child that had been abused probably for her whole life. I think that Burke eventually will talk because he was a product of that abusive household, and those kids, as they grow up and as they come to grips with these things, do like to talk. So I do think
they like to surf the internet as well, don't they? That's another thing that parents don't take into consideration.
Yep. It was, I think, an unintended death, and I think that John May probably said too much that night, and they set the crime scene to make it look like it was a sexual torture type of situation, but it wasn't. In fact, it was probably she fell and hit her head on the bathtub or something like that and eyes rolled to the back of it, or she was shaken, something like that.
Yeah, I wonder why it was so important that she had the pineapple at midnight or thereabouts. Yeah,
I've always
thought that. I've always
thought
that.
Cassie was caught in a lie. Cassie did not want the police to know that she had gotten up in the middle of the night. So she said, no, JonBenet did not eat pineapple. She wasn't up. And they knew from the autopsy that the pineapple had just been a couple hours old.
Right.
So Cassie got caught in that lie.
She did.
And totally did. People have a reason to lie.
Yes.
So anyway, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you both.
Oh, it has been. Oh, my gosh.
And I love your accents, by the way.
What?
Your accents. The accents that I don't have.
So like you talk.
I love your accent. I want to talk like Hobnob, so I'm going to acknowledge her, and I don't think I can do it. Okay, never mind. I love
Good
you,
show,
baby.
Ladies.
Good show.
Take care.
And I'm going to sign off here. Thanks to our public relations team at imaginepublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night.
Good night, all.
Good night, Peter. Good night, Hobbs. I love you, baby.
Oh,
see you in a couple weeks. Bye.
Bye-bye, babes. Bye-bye.